Well, thank you so much, and it's a tremendous honor to be here. And I want you to know how much I respect your pastor, Paul Blair, precious wife, Cindy, and how God is using them in such a powerful way. And he is a real inspiration to me. So he's not here, so I'm not doing it to butter up. He truly is a great spiritual leader that God has brought together to challenge us in these times. And even there's a little bit of a prophetic aspect to his ministry where he's like speaking things and a courageous leader that I so much respect. And well, with that, I have a PowerPoint presentation that goes through history that hopefully will help us to understand what's going on today. And I don't know how long it's been since the last time I've been here. Some of the stuff I don't know if I've repeated before, but if I said it before, you probably forgot it by now, so I can say it again. And so let's just jump in, and there's approximately 5,000 or 6,000 years of recorded human history. Writing was invented around 3300 BC, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. Right? Today, that's Iraq. And Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist, and in his Cosmos TV series, he said it was here around 5,000 years ago between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that we learned how to write. So writing was invented around 5,000 years. If you round it out, let's say 6,000. 6,000 years is not that long. It's only 60 people living 100 years each back to back. So how many of you have met someone who's lived 100 years or close to it, right? Maybe a grandmother, like Pastor Paul Blair's mom, right? Getting close to that. We're talking 60 people living 100 years each back to back, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. So it's not that long ago. Well, now that we have 6,000 years of records, what do they show? They show there's been a 6,000-year quest to rule the world. And the first recorded story we have is Nimrod, Tower of Babel. And the Jewish commentator Josephus said Nimrod wanted to build the tower so high that if God destroyed the world again with a flood, he could survive on top. So the tower sort of had this defiant, in-your-face attitude toward God. And supposedly, Nimrod made everyone bake bricks and bring them. And if they did not do that, he would kill them. So it was this defiant against God, oppressive over man. And God comes down and confuses the languages and the people what? Scatter. And so we see this first illustration of power concentrated and power separated. So everyone put up a fist in one hand and say concentrated power, fingers apart with the other hand, say separated power. Now back to the fist, concentrated power. That is world history. For most of world history, power is concentrated in the hands of the Caesars, Pharaohs, Kaisers, Sultans, Czars, and very rarely is power separated into the hands of the people. But in times of crises, the people panic and let go of the power, and it rubber band snaps back into the hands of a king. So God scatters them at the Tower of Babel, but it's almost like every generation since has tried to rebuild the Tower of Babel, but only on a bigger scale each time. Because with military advancements, you can kill more people. So instead of killing with Cain killed Abel with a stone weapon, now they're killing with bronze weapons or iron weapons or a big long phalanx spear that Alexander the Great's men had, or a composite bow that the Mongols had, or a scimitar sword that the Muslims had, or gunpowder. The weapon changes, but it's that same fallen nature of Cain killing Abel. Anyway, so have you ever seen the movie The Terminator with Arnold Schwarzenegger? There's this killer metal robot from the future. They blow the thing up and everybody sighs relief. But then the pieces of little metal parts get silvery and drip together into little droplets, and then they roll together into a silvery pool. Then out of this pool comes the head of this Terminator, and it climbs out and starts chasing him again. And everyone in the audience says, how do you get rid of this thing? It's like, how do you get rid of this Tower of Babel? Every generation keeps trying to rebuild the thing. And now one of the things I found interesting is in nature, there is a rate of geometric expansion. It's called phi, P-H-I, or the golden ratio, or the Fibonacci sequence. And if you see it in a seashell, it's the little circle, a little bigger circle, little bigger, bigger circle. It's observable in tornadoes and in hurricanes and even in galaxies, this rate of expansion. And I had a thought, would it apply chronologically to these empires throughout world history? Right? And so we see the first empire is this Nimrod Tower of Babel. And then, and that's probably around 3,000, 2,500 BC. And then there's Gilgamesh, the king of Uruk or Iraq. And he was around 2,500 BC. Gilgamesh was the first one to build a wall around a city. That was his big invention. Gee, a wall. What an interesting idea. And Gilgamesh went on this long journey to meet this old guy who survived a global flood. And he talks about this old guy having built a boat, covered it with tar and pitch, filled it full of animals. After the flood, it settled on a mountaintop and they repopulated the world. It's the story of Noah, right? So here we are in this ancient Assyrian, Akkadian language, and 1,000 years before Moses. Matter of fact, over 100 ancient civilizations have flood stories and flood legends in their ancient past. Gee, maybe there was a flood. And so after Gilgamesh and a walled city, you had Sargon of Akkadia around 2250 BC. He conquers a bunch of walled cities, and it's the first empire. And then you have 2,000 years of Egyptian pharaohs. And they own the people, the cattle, the land. And then you have 5,000 years of Chinese emperors. And then around 700 BC, Assyria is the biggest empire in the world. The capital is Nineveh, right? And the story of Jonah, and also Assyria took the 10 northern tribes of Israel captive. But Assyria was conquered by Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, and then Babylon was conquered by Cyrus of Persia. He had the biggest empire that the world had ever seen. And of course, he's the one who let the Jews go back and rebuild the temple. But the Persian Empire is conquered by Alexander the Great. And he has the biggest empire in the world around 330 BC. But he stopped from going into India. And India has Chandragupta. And he has the biggest empire, all of India, a quarter of the world's population. And then around 25 BC, Augustus Caesar has the biggest empire in the world. And he wants to track everyone. He wants a worldwide tracking system. It was called a census. Right? Augustus Caesar, the census. Something about dictators, they want to track everyone that's under their thumb. And then around 450 AD, Attila the Hun comes and he conquers the what's left of the Roman Empire. And he has an army of 500,000 soldiers. And the Christians at the time thought he was the Antichrist. And then he stopped, and the Byzantine Empire takes over where the Romans left off, and Justinian, and he has this huge empire. But then the Byzantine Empire weakens, and Islam comes along, and it has the biggest empire the world had seen, from Persia all across North Africa, all of Spain. It went from the Persian Gulf to the Atlantic Ocean. But the Muslims conquered into France, and they were stopped by Charles Martel, whose grandson is Charlemagne. And so Charlemagne has this biggest empire of all of Europe. And then in 1200 AD, Genghis Khan, and he kills 30 million people and conquers from Korea to Hungary to Russia. And he has the biggest empire. And his grandson is Kublai Khan that runs all of China. And then in the 1300s, Tamerlane conquers all of Central Asia, kills 17 million people, and he has this enormous empire. And then Ivan the Terrible of Russia in the 1400s. And Russia is, it's 12 time zones. I mean, this is an enormous country. He kills 60,000 at Novgorod to take over. Well, then you cross the ocean and you come to the Americas. And it has centralized power with Montezuma, the head of the Aztecs, right? And ripping people's hearts out to the sun god. And Atahualpa in Inca Peru. Every single citizen in Peru was an employee of the state, run by Atahualpa, who claimed to be a delegate of the sun god. And then the 1500s, the king of Spain has the biggest empire that the planet had ever seen. Sun never set on the Spanish Empire. The Philippines are named after his son, King Philip of Spain. 1600s, France has the biggest empire. Matter of fact, everything west of the Mississippi River, or everything west of the Appalachians belonged to the king of France. And then in the late 17 and early 1800s, England has the largest empire that planet Earth had ever seen. And the king of England was the most powerful king in the world. They had 13 million square miles, a half a billion people. He was a one-world government globalist with him at the top. And so we see that these empires keep going and going and going and going. Why do they keep repeating themselves? Because it's in the fallen human nature. When Adam and Eve sinned and that selfishness came in, and Cain kills Abel. And this lust for power of Cain killing Abel, it's just one king taking a kingdom from another king. St. Augustine called it libido dominandi, the lust to dominate. And so you put some babies in a playpen, one of them takes the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one of them is the bully hogging the ball. You put some junior high girls in a clique, and one of them is the diva. You put some natives in the woods, and one of them is an Indian chief. And you put them in an inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And all a king is a glorified gang leader. It's a hierarchical system. If you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you are less equal. And if you are an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason, or you're a slave. And so it's this pyramid structure to society that keeps repeating itself all around the world. Why? Because it's in fallen human nature. Now, what if you were the king? That'd be pretty neat. And let's say you have a sister, and you really love her, and she has a teenage son, and he starts to hang around the wrong kids, drink and drive and party, and he hits someone with the car and kills him. And now this teenager is facing mandatory prison time. And your sister comes begging to you and says, "You're not going to let my little Johnny get locked away, are you? What are you going to say to your sister?" "Well, I'll let little Johnny off the hook this time, but don't let it happen again." Guess what? As soon as you say that, you are the corrupt dictator. You just sent ripples through your kingdom that if someone is family or friends with the king, they get special treatment. Somebody's not family or friends, they don't get it. And if someone wants to point out your favoritism, you will be tempted to want to shut them up. And so it just happens. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so it's this gravitational pull, like the pull of a magnet, and it's in the human DNA. Even the movie The Lord of the Rings, there's a line where Gandalf tells Frodo, "Always remember, Frodo, the ring is trying to get back to its master. It wants to be found." And in the movie, Gandalf goes on to say, "I would take the ring wanting to do good, but it would end up corrupting me." And so this is an interesting phenomenon that you have Joseph, a really good guy in Egypt, concentrates power into the hands of the Pharaoh. What does the Pharaoh do with this concentrated power? He takes care of the children of Israel, gives them food, gives them the best land at Goshen, gives them jobs, take care of his cattle. But then there was a new Pharaoh that did not know Joseph, and he used all that concentrated power to oppress the children of Israel, even to the extent of making them throw their kids in the Nile River. So that's the dilemma. You get good people in office, and they want to concentrate power so they can do good more efficiently, and it gets, and it's almost like the devil sits back for a generation and says, fine, do your thing, because at some time it's going to come back around to me. I'm going to use that concentrated power to oppress people. And so the founding fathers understood that you take the power of the king and you separate it, right? I tell people, if you were accused of a crime, would you rather go before one politically appointed judge? He's really efficient. Or would you rather go before 12 of your peers? Now, it may take a long time for a trial. It may be embarrassing, maybe front page news. But this is your future. You're either going to be free or in prison the rest of your life. Who would you rather go before? Trust the many or trust the few? Our founding fathers were faced with that. And like, we experienced the few. We experienced what it's like with justice from the hands of a king. And if you're not his friend, you won't get a fair shake. Let's try the separated power. Let's try trusting the people. So they took that power from the Tower of Babel and separated it. Now, this trend for power to want to concentrate has a global goal. And so you have Cain killing Abel, Nimrod, Tower of Babel, Pharaoh, Caesars, Kaisers throughout the 6,000 years of history. Ultimately, there is a global goal in mind, and that's left for the chapter of Revelation. People say, well, history repeats itself. Yeah, but every time it comes around, it's a little bit worse. Because with military advancements, you can kill more people, and with technological advancements, you can track more people. But from the scriptural point of view, God chooses for us to be alive at this time in history, and he has a plan to use us. So the crises in the period, so every generation has had crises. The bubonic plague, Attila the Hun, World War I, the Spanish flu. Every generation has crises. And the crises of that generation is an opportunity for the people that are alive at that period of time to respond three different ways. Be part of the problem. Hey, let's sell marijuana, or ignore the problem, or be part of ministering God's grace to, and God's righteousness and God's will in the crisis of the situation. Does that make sense? So it's almost like every generation, there's a crisis, and it's sort of a self-sorting out of the sheep and the goats. Not the ultimate sheep and the goat separation that happens in the Day of Judgment, but it's almost like we get to choose. Are we going to be part of the problem? Are we going to ignore the problem? Or are we going to be part of the answer? I heard someone say, there's three groups of people, those that make things happen, those that watch things happen, and those that wonder what happened. And you're going to be with those that make things happen. Anyway, so God knew what was in Abraham's heart. But he wanted to see Abraham take his son Isaac to the top of Mount Moriah and be willing to sacrifice him. God knows what's in your heart, but he wants to hear some words out of your mouth and see some actions. I tell men, imagine if a guy's sitting on his couch and it's great to have you back, Pastor. Oh, God bless you. Oh, God bless you. Oh. Well, your pastor is a great inspiration to me. And so a guy sitting on his couch watching TV, and it's like, hey, have you told your wife you loved her recently? No, but she knows what's in my heart. Have you done anything to show your wife you love her recently? No, but she knows my heart. It's like, dude, you better say something and do something. It's like, well, you know, hey, God knows my heart. It's like, yes, but he wants to hear something out of your mouth, and he wants to see some actions, right? Anyway, so every generation has crisis, and, you know, if we get through this crisis, there'll be another one. You know, I mean, here's the Soviet Union, this great big evil enemy, and we also, if we can just get rid of it. Oh, fine, we got rid of it, and then Islam crisis comes along. Or there's always going to be crisis, and the crisis is an opportunity for us to respond, let God's will manifest through us in this crisis. And so moving on. Kings. Now, these kings claimed to be divinely appointed. I have a part I sort of left out, but I mentioned that the first invention ever was the plow. So the first trade, so to speak, was transitioning from being hunter-gatherers to agriculture, right? You read these books on anthropology, and they go from, you know, gathering the stuff to agriculture. Once a society moves to agriculture, they need to know when to plant the crops. So they need to keep track of the seasons, which means they need to keep track of the stars. So they would build these big, immovable structures to observe the stars. Stonehenge, pyramids, ziggurats, whatever, all had to do with the stars and the alignment. And somebody got to climb up the building or the structure and look at the stars and come back down with this secret knowledge from heaven as to when to plant the barley. Right? And when to plant the oats and when to plant. And this person claimed to be an intermediary between the heavens and these commoners below. And so this began to go turn into the divine right of kings. And anyway, so here you have the king, Louis the 14th of France, called the Sun King. He says, I am the state. And one time they said, King, you can't do this particular thing. It's illegal. He says, it is legal because I wish it. Oh, okay, I get it. The law is nothing more than your wishes. And you just happen to have a really powerful army to make people obey you. Here's King James of England. And I'll get into him a little bit more, but King James says, kings are God's lieutenants upon earth, sit upon God's throne. The king is the overlord of the whole land, master over every person, having power over the life and death of everyone. So can you begin to see why the pilgrims wanted to flee, right? And all, so forth. So the British Empire, the biggest empire the planet Earth had ever seen, it took centuries, millennium, for America's founders to break away from a king. And they actually flipped it and made the people the king. That's the title of one of my books over there, Who is the King in America? So James Wilson, signer of the Declaration, said, after a period of 6,000 years since creation, the United States exhibit to the world the first instance of a nation assembling voluntarily and deciding that system of government under which they should live. So he mentions the number of 6,000, and he says something really unique happened in America. Daniel Webster, Secretary of State, said, miracles do not cluster. What has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. Hold on to the Constitution, for if the American Constitution should fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world. Now, why would there be anarchy throughout the world? Because for 6,000 years, people that are suffering under dictators and pharaohs and kaisers and sultans and czars and, you know, communist leaders, they all say, if only we could rule ourselves without a king, how wonderful it would be. And here in America, we did it. And if we blow it, there's nothing left for humanity to look forward to, right? This side of heaven. And so, how did America, our form of government, come about? So I do a little background. In my books, I get into it a little bit more. I talk about how the Muslims conquered North Africa, then they conquered into Greece in the 1400s, and the Greek scholars fled west, and they brought with them their Greek art and architecture. We call this the Renaissance. They all happened to bring over their Greek New Testaments, and now scholars in Western Europe can read the Bible in Greek, like Erasmus, and he was friends with Martin Luther. And so this laid the foundation for the Reformation. So in the 1500s in the world, you have the two biggest kings. The King of Spain, he's called the Holy Roman Emperor, and the Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent of the Ottoman Empire. And Sultan Suleiman controls this huge area. Martin Luther starts the Reformation, and you had some German princes decide that they're going to use this Reformation as an opportunity to break away from Rome and to stop being Catholic and so forth. And so here's the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V of Spain. He controlled all of Europe, basically, and he's trying to stop this Muslim invasion, and now he's got all these German kingdoms splintering off. And he realizes that he can't fight the Muslims and the Protestants. And so he does a treaty in 1555 with the Protestants. It's the first treaty ever to recognize Protestants. At that time, it was just the Lutherans, but to recognize them in a treaty. And the treaty had basically said, look, Protestants, I'm not really happy with you, but I need you to work together with us to stop this Islamic invasion. And so there's a little Latin phrase in the treaty, and the phrase is cuius regio ius religio, which means whose is the reign, his is the religion. So every king got to decide what's going to be believed in his kingdom. So in other words, okay, look, Protestant prince, Believe whatever you want in your kingdom. I just need you to work together with me to stop this Islamic invasion. Now, in reading through history, had the king of Spain been able to stop the Muslims on his own, he would have done it, and he would have continued to oppress the Protestants. But it was such a serious threat that he was pushed to have to make this deal with the Protestants. Now, this is significant because Europe began to expand in religious freedom. So in Europe, you had one Christian denomination per country. What the king believed, the kingdom had to believe. But if you did not believe the way your king did, you were persecuted and you fled. And so we begin to see that Germany became Lutheran, Switzerland became Calvinist, Scotland became Presbyterian, Holland became Dutch Reformed, England became Anglican, and so forth. So they were all splintering up, but you still had to believe the way your king did. And so in England, you had a king, Henry VIII, and he was married to the daughter of the king of Spain, Catherine of Aragon. After 18 years, she did not have a son, so Henry VIII decides to divorce her. The Pope won't recognize the divorce because she is, after all, the daughter of the most powerful guy in the world, the king of Spain. So Henry decides he's going to make himself his own pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and he goes on to have six wives, not at the same time. And their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to. Well, his advisors suggested if he was serious about breaking from Rome, he needed to stop using the Latin Bible, get himself an English Bible. The German princes had Martin Luther's German Bible that helped them to break away from Rome. He needed an English Bible. Well, it just so happens a couple years earlier, he had William Tyndale burnt at the stake for translating the Bible into English. But now he wants an English Bible. And so they basically take it, redo it, and they call it the Great Bible. And he spreads it all around England. And he dusts his hands and says, "That's it. We got our English Bible. We're separated from Rome." But something unexpected happened. People began to read it and began to compare. It was called the Chained Bible because they would chain it to the pulpit because it was so valuable. But it was the first time in history that the common people in England had access to reading the Bible. They would rent time. "Your 15 minutes is up. It's my turn." Now they hurry up and open the Bible and read it in their own language, right? But then people began to believe things a little bit different. And they would break off into little splinter groups. And the king didn't expect this. And he's like, "Look, you can read the Bible in your own language, but you still have to believe what I tell you to believe." And so he passes the Act of Uniformity of Common Prayer. In other words, you don't just make up a prayer. You read a prayer from the approved book. There's prayers for weddings, prayers for funerals, prayers for everything, but you read the approved prayer. You don't make up a prayer, right? And so then the king passed the 5-mile act. If you are caught preaching within 5 miles of a town, you're a criminal unless you have approval from the king. And they passed a law in 1664 called the Conventicle Act. It comes from the word covenant. But if you have 5 or more people meeting in your home or wherever and you're talking religion without approval of the king, you're a criminal. And they'll bust in and arrest everyone. Who was arrested? John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress. He was having a Bible study, but he wasn't approved by the king. They bust in and arrest him. Now he's in prison 12 years and he writes Pilgrim's Progress. And then they pass the Riot Act, R-I-O-T. The king said, "Well, if you have 12 or more people meeting, you could be planning a riot. And so I'm going to outlaw 12 or more non-Anglicans from meeting. And if you were meeting, the police would bust into your home and they would pull out this piece of paper and they would read the Riot Act, which says you must immediately disperse or you will be arrested, put in prison, and even killed." And that went into our vernacular of an extremely severe response. Read them the Riot Act, right? So, if you were caught, you were drugged before the Star Chamber, and it's a room in the government building with stars on the ceiling, and they would twist your arm, cut off your ear, cut your nose in half, brand you on the face as a heretic, for not believing the way the king did. Or they would put you in the Newgate prison where they would leave you until you died. One of the people who died in the Newgate prison was Thomas Helwys, H-E-L-W-Y-S, and he's one of the founders of the Baptist faith in England. And they put him in prison, and they would not let him have any writing instruments because he would write these pamphlets. And they did not feed you in a British prison. You had to have some friend that missed you and would find out you're there and bring you food. So he had a friend that brought him a bottle of milk, but instead of a cork, it had a wad of paper. And he unfolded the paper, took a splinter of wood, dipped it in the milk, and he wrote out his pamphlets. It dried. It was clear. He folds up the paper, sticks it in the empty milk bottle, and they stick it outside the door. His friend comes and takes it, brings it home, lights a candle, holds the piece of paper over the candle so the heat would turn the milk brown, and they would see what he wrote, and they would print out these pamphlets. One of the pamphlets said, if the king can stand there on the day of judgment and answer for your conscience, fine, believe whatever the king tells you to believe. But if the king is not going to be there on the day of judgment, you are accountable to God for your own conscience. Right? Kings didn't like that. They wanted you believing what they told you to believe. When I blow my trumpets, you bow to my statue. I don't care if you have a warm feeling in your heart for my statue. You bow or you're going to go in the fiery furnace. Kings want to insert themselves between you and God. They want to be that divine intermediary between you and heaven. God's jealous. He doesn't want any intermediary. He wants you to have a personal relationship with him. Right? Anyway, so you got the Newgate prison. Pilgrims flee. Pilgrims flee from England to Holland. Holland fought an 80-year war of independence from Spain. And there were seven provinces in Holland, and they learned a little give and take with each other because Spain was, they did the Spanish Furies in 1572 where they came in and just butchered and killed everyone in Antwerp, Holland, and so forth. So Holland had a little give and take. And so it was the most tolerant country in Europe. And so the pilgrims said, let's flee to Holland. And so they fled. They're there for 12 years. Spain threatens to attack. They flee again. The pilgrims decide they're going to go across the ocean to the new colony of Virginia. They thought, well, it's still under the king's thumb, but we're 3,000 miles away. So he probably won't be watching us every day, and we can sort of do our little pilgrim religion, and we'll be fine. So they get in their boat, and they take off from England, and there's storms. Their boat leaks. They got to go back. They do it again, leaks again. And, finally they're sailing in the wintertime, and it's stormy, 102 of them in a four-foot-high space, a little between deck, and they land on the shores of America. And they're 500 miles away from Jamestown. And they think, well, let's just get in our boat, sail down the coast. Well, off the coast of Cape Cod, it's really shallow with sand. And you could be a mile away from the coast, and it's shallow, and the boat would get stuck on the sand. And when a storm is happening, you're stuck in the sand, and the storm beats the boat, and the boat sinks. So there's 3,000 boats that have sunk off the coast of Cape Cod. So the pilgrims almost sink. And the captain says, it is too dangerous to sail. He goes back to Plymouth Rock, and he says, everyone off the boat. And they're like, who's going to be in charge? We were going to go to Virginia, submit to the government there. There's no king-appointed person on our boat. Who's going to be in charge? They do something unique. They decide to give themselves the authority to start a government. It's called the Mayflower Compact. And one of the lines, we, in ye presence of God, covenant ourselves together into a civil body politic, to enact just and equal laws as shall be thought most meet or necessary, unto which we promise all due submission. Simple, revolutionary. It was a polarity change in the flow of power. Instead of top-down, ruled by kings, it's bottom-up, ruled by we. In the womb of this little Mayflower boat is this DNA change, right? Is this child that is formed, that is birth. It's the difference between a dead pyramid ruled from the top down, which is the norm for 6,000 years of history, or a bottom up, like a tree, where every root and every little capillary root sucks in nutrients to keep the tree alive. It is a bottom-up form of government. Difference between divine right of kings and we the people. So where did the pilgrims get this idea that they could rule themselves without a king? From their pastor, John Robinson. He was considered one of the founders of the Congregationalist Church. This painting, by the way, hangs in our U.S. Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. So the pilgrims had a congregational form of church government where everybody is involved. In the nursery, in the junior high, and right, and you're faithful in the very little, you're entrusted with more, you work your way up in responsibility, right? And it's drawn from the word ecclesia. It's a Greek word meaning assembly. Ek means out of, ecclesia means a calling. And so in Athens, they had 6,000 citizens, and they would call them out of their houses to the marketplace to decide what the city's going to do. And so Jesus chose, in the Greek New Testament, he says, upon this rock I will build my ecclesia, a congregation, a body, the body of Christ. Everybody's involved. Everybody takes responsibility. We move up, right? And when they were, so we have the Great Bible, and then there's the Geneva Bible, and all these Bibles had margin notes that talked about not having to submit to the king and so forth. King James didn't like the margin notes. So he decides he's going to do a new Bible that is so good that there'll never have to be any more translations. So he has three different groups and they check each other's, and it has stood the test of time. The King James Bible is the world's best-selling book. But King James did give a few instructions to the translators. One of the instructions was he did not want any novel words such as congregation. He wanted the word ecclesia translated church. Why? Because he wanted to be the head of the Anglican Church. And how can you be the head of something when the body's involved in the ministry and the deliberation? Right? And so this is the hierarchy. We got the king, the monarch, Archbishop Canterbury, bishops and deacons and vicars and curates and everything, and he's at the top. And so the difference was he was drawing from the Bible from King Saul on. The Puritans and the Pilgrims and the Congregationalists drew from the Bible that period pre-King Saul, that first 400-year period when Israel came out of Egypt. They were a congregation. They were an assembly. And that was the original plan that God had. So, non-conforming pastors in England had to flee. And they fled over to Holland, and they fled to Massachusetts, and they founded these communities. And so, you had in New England, a Reverend John Lothrop and his church founded Barnstable, Massachusetts. Reverend Roger Williams and his church founded Providence, Rhode Island. And Reverend John Wheelwright and his church founded Exeter, New Hampshire. And Reverend Thomas Hooker and his church founded Hartford, Connecticut. This was unique on planet Earth. At a time when you had Muslim sultans, Russian czars, Chinese emperors, African chieftains, King of Spain, France, Austria, everything is kings. Here you have this little greenhouse in New England where pastors and their churches are founding communities. And so 50 years before Europe's Age of Enlightenment and John Locke's treaties, two treaties of government, you have Thomas Hooker. He's a pastor in Massachusetts. Well, the Puritans were persecuted in England. They fled to Massachusetts, but then they sort of repeated the error by insisting everybody be Puritan. And you had Thomas Hooker. The difference was Puritans said only Puritans could vote in city elections. Thomas Hooker said anybody that's a Christian should be allowed to vote in city elections. As big as that difference was, Thomas Hooker decided, church, we're leaving. Next Saturday, meet in the parking lot with your cows and your wagons, and we're taking off. And they did, and they went 14 weeks, and they followed up and down the hills, and they finally found a place that they called Hartford, Connecticut. And so they're there. And the people in the church go to their pastor and say, hey, pastor, it's great to be here. How do we set up the government? And so he gives a sermon. And in Thomas Hooker's sermon, he says, the foundation of authority is laid firstly in the free consent of the people. And he went back to ancient Israel, and God gave the law, but then the people got together on the two mountains, and then they agreed, say, we will submit to this law, and so the people gave their consent. And so Thomas Hooker says, the foundation of authority is laid firstly, free consent. This concept of free consent is reflected in our declaration, government from the consent of the governed. And this was revolutionary because, again, at the time, the world's ruled by kings, and this is a change in the flow of power. Hooker says the privilege of election belongs to the people according to the blessed will and law of God. This phrase, the people, is reflected in our Constitution. We, the people. Thomas Hooker goes on, they who have the power to appoint officers and magistrates, it is also in their power to set the bounds and limitations of the power. So his sermon is written down, and it is called the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. It is the Constitution for Connecticut from 1639 up until 1818. Thomas Hooker, the pastor's sermon, is the Constitution for Connecticut. Now notice the year 1818. When the colonies broke from Britain, other colonies got rid of their charters and wrote constitutions, not Connecticut. They continued to use Thomas Hooker's sermon as their constitution up until 1818. It's John Fiske, a historian, called the first written constitution, became a blueprint for the other colonies, and eventually the U.S. Constitution. That's why Connecticut is called the Constitution State. They even have it on their license plate. Here's a plaque in England. It says Thomas Hooker, curate and so forth, and it says founder of the state of Connecticut, father of American democracy. Huh. Did you know that over in England, they think this pastor that you never heard of before is the father of American democracy? Here's another plaque in England. Thomas Hooker, Puritan clergyman, reputed father of American democracy. Here's a statue of Thomas Hooker holding a Bible on the old Capitol grounds in Hartford, Connecticut. At the base of the statue, it says, leading his people through the wilderness, he founded Hartford. And then it says, on this site, he preached the sermon, which inspired the fundamental orders. It was the first written constitution that created a government. Here's another plaque in Hartford. It says, Thomas Hooker preached his famous sermon. The foundation of authority is laid in the free consent of the people. And then the people have representatives, and they pass the fundamental orders. And what do the fundamental orders say? The people can join ourselves to be as one public state or commonwealth. Sounds like the Mayflower. We covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic. Why? To preserve the liberty and purity of the gospel of our Lord Jesus. In other words, the government was formed to best preserve the liberty to believe the gospel. The gospel is the premier thing. The government's job is to support the freedom that you have to voluntarily believe rather than be enforced by a king. Here's another plaque in Hartford. They have lots of plaques in Hartford. And it says, Thomas Hooker's congregation established the form of government upon which the present Constitution of the United States is modeled. Do you catch the significance of this? His congregation government became the model for our U.S. government. His sermon. And so in New England, instead of separation of church and state, it was the pastors and their churches that created the state. How could you say, pastor, don't get involved in politics when it's his sermon that's the Constitution? How could you say church members don't get involved in politics when all there was in Hartford was the church members? So Calvin Coolidge said, the principles which went into the Declaration of Independence are found in the sermons of the early colonial clergy. They preached equality because they believed in the fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man. In order that they might have freedom to express these thoughts and opportunities to put them into action, whole congregations with their pastors migrated to the colonies. So, these pastors, they did an experiment in New England. They realized that the kingdom of God could never be forced from the top down. They fled from Europe, where kings were burning people at the stake for not believing the way the king did. They saw in the scriptures that Jesus never forced anyone to believe in him. Matter of fact, you look at the scriptures, Jesus multiplied loaves and fishes, fed 5,000, and a crowd was following him, wanting to make him king. And he said difficult things, like, I'm the bread of life, unless you eat my body and have my, drink my blood, you have no part in me. And he had to know that they would have trouble understanding it. But it was almost like he said something intentionally that would shake away those that were following him for the wrong reason. And so a bunch of them said, this is a difficult saying, who can bear it? And they walked with him no more. He didn't run after them and say, no, you misunderstood me. He turned to Peter and says, you want to go too? Peter says, where else can I go? You're the only one with the words of eternal life. So you contrast this. Jesus didn't run after him with a sword and get back here or I'll chop your head off. In other words, he intentionally were to shake away those. So if Jesus himself never forced anyone to believe in him, we can't. And so these pastors in New England said, look, if the kingdom of God cannot be forced from the top down, how will it ever happen? Well, they thought that if the majority of the people held godly values and elected representatives with those values, then laws would be passed reflecting those values, and the values of the kingdom could come voluntarily percolating from the bottom up, not forcibly shoved from the top down. So this is the difference that took place in America, right? So again, instead of divine right of kings, the creator gives all the power to the king and he's God's lieutenant dispensing it to these lowly people. No, we conveniently leave out the king. And we say the creator gives the rights directly to each person. We are all equal and we choose from amongst ourselves who's going to temporarily be our political leaders, right? Do you see the difference here? And Calvin Coolidge said, placing every man on a plane where he acknowledged no superiors, he must inevitably choose his own rulers through a system of self-government. So fine, we're all equal, but who's going to fix the potholes in the road? Okay, let's come up with a way of voting. Okay, who's going to, fix the bridge? Who's going to do this or that? So, question, where did the pastors get the idea that people could rule themselves without a king? Well, they looked a little bit at England, Magna Carta, which King John, who was the brother of King Richard the Lionheart, he did the Third Crusade, came back, and then died 5 years later. So King John took over England, and he's arbitrarily throwing people in jail and taking away land from his barons. And so one day, the king is riding out of his castle, and he comes over a hill, and he is surrounded by thousands of soldiers. The 25 barons in England all got together. They surrounded him with their armies, and they said, you ain't leaving here until you sign this document, which says what? The king can't arbitrarily throw people in prison, can't arbitrarily take away, and if you pick on any one of us, the other 24 will gang up on you. And so the king was all upset, but he ends up signing this Magna Carta. So the founders looked to that as limiting the king. They looked to Roman Republic. Rome had 600 senators. They ruled as a republic for 500 years until Julius Caesar found a way to usurp power, make himself dictator for life. They did get some ideas from the Athenian democracy until Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, found out that he could bribe citizens of Athens with money under the table and they would betray his own city, and so he took over. But these pastors in New England really got their ideas from the Bible. And you think, really? They did? Yeah, they actually taught Hebrew at Yale and Harvard. Do you know that in the 1660s they actually gave the commencement sermon at Harvard in the Hebrew language? Can you imagine all the students getting together and now they're getting the address? Anyway, now, address in Hebrew. So, this is interesting. So you say, Bill, do you have any real solid evidence that the Hebrews influenced the founding of America? Well, the U.S. Constitution was written, but it needed to be ratified by 9 states before it went into action. And they had 8, and New Hampshire was in line to be the 9th, but it was having a deadlock, and they almost voted against it. So they suspend the convention. They actually have a day of fasting for the colony. They get back together, and Harvard President Samuel Langdon gives the New Hampshire Ratifying Convention an address titled "The Republic of the Israelites, an Example to the American States." He goes on, "Instead of the 12 tribes of Israel, we may substitute the 13 states of the American Union and see this application plainly." Well, guess what? After his address, they vote, they ratify, they are the 9th state to ratify, and the U.S. Constitution goes into effect. Our U.S. Constitution went into effect after the sermon, "The Republic of the Israelites, an Example to the American States." What was the Republic of the Israelites? It was that first 400-year period when they came out of Egypt into the Promised Land before they got King Saul. And where there's a king, everyone wants to butter up and be friends with the king. And so in Israel, there was no royal family to butter up next to. And the law specifically said there is no respect of persons in judgment. Rich or poor, everyone's the same. Male, female, made in the image of the Creator. This is the beginning of the concept of equality on planet Earth. You mean everybody I see is equal to me? There's no royal family that everybody wants to be friends with? So in ancient Israel, everyone was equal. Israel comes up with this idea of tolerance. Here they were worshiping the one true God, and they never felt compelled to force anyone to become an Israelite. Get your lamb, drag it to the temple. No. And Israel was the first nation with private land ownership. You see, wherever there's a king, you never really own the land. It is always conditional of you staying on the nice side of the king. You cross the king, he will take away the land and kill you. And in Israel, the land was permanently titled to each family. Now, if you own land, you can accumulate stuff. The Bible called that being blessed. Karl Marx called it being a capitalist. You got stuff, you worked hard, you saved it. So it's the promised land because people actually got to have title to the land. Ancient Israel had no police. Everyone was taught the law. Everyone helped enforce the law. It was like everybody was deputized. We have a little of that, today with traffic laws, right? And somebody's weaving in and out. You take it upon yourself to honk the horn, right? You help enforce. And maybe a mom watching a bunch of neighborhood kids. She has no problem correcting somebody else's kid. Well, guess what? In ancient Israel, everybody corrected everybody else. It was like everybody was deputized. Ancient Israel had no standing army. You have a king, he has an army to enforce his will. In ancient Israel, every man was in the militia and armed with a sword upon their thigh, and they were ready at a moment's notice to defend their family and their community. Ancient Israel had no prisons, right? So when Joseph was in prison for several years in Egypt. Well, in Israel, when a crime was committed, you got the accused and the elders of the city, and you had the trial immediately. And, of course, there was a city of refuge that someone could run away to await the trial. Israel had a bureaucracy-free welfare system. So in Egypt, people were selling their souls to the Pharaoh for a bag of grain. In Israel, when somebody harvested their field, they left the gleanings, the corners, for the poor people to pick through, like Ruth. This way, the poor were taken care of on a cellular level, so to speak, and they kept their dignity because they did a little something without some political leader collecting everything and doling it back out as favors to those that can help him stay in power. Israel had a system of honesty. God hates unjust weights and measures. This became the basis for commerce. You could trust people. And Israel got to choose their own leaders of their different tribes. Moses spake unto the children of Israel, saying, "How can I myself alone bear your burden?" take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I'll make them rulers over you. This was an election process. He didn't go out among 3 million people and say, you're in charge. No. He tells says, take you wise men, known among your tribes. Do you know people that hate covetousness and that, you know, refuse to take bribes and everything? You know them, right? So this was so anyone in ancient Israel could be raised up into leadership. And you see the story of Gideon from a nobody family, became a leader. Here's even Deborah, a woman. She's not related to royalty. She just knows the law. She's honest. Her reputation spreads. She sits under a tree. People make their way all the way across the country for her to hear their case and tell them what the law says. Where else in the world could a woman become a leader who's not related to royalty? So Harvard President Samuel Langdon finishes out his address. He says, the Israelites may be considered as a pattern to the world in all ages of government on Republican principles. From abject slavery, a mere mob, to a well-regulated nation under laws far superior to what any other nation could boast. Think of it. They go from 400 years of slavery. They can't even read. They come out of Egypt, and suddenly they get downloaded the most unique form of government that planet Earth had ever seen, that's totally contrary to human nature of wanting to usurp power. That in itself has to prove that it was divine, right? It's so contrary to human nature. And this was interesting. By the way, I don't know if somebody's got an extra water bottle that... ancient Israel was the first nation that could read. And so at the time Moses came out of Egypt, Sumeria had 1,500 cuneiform characters. I don't know about you, but memorizing 1,500 anythings is not fun. But it was only for the kings and the scribes. And then Egypt had 3,000 hieroglyphic characters. Oh, thank you. You shall not lose your reward. And so only 1% of Egypt could read. Reading and writing was the scribes' secret knowledge. They actually kept the hieroglyphs complicated on purpose as job security. They were needed to interpret these complicated things. And then China, at the time, had 10,000 pictogram Chinese-type characters invented by the Yellow Emperor and so forth. But again, just for court records for the emperor. Only the upper class could read. It was sort of like the communication of the deep state, where they knew what was going on, but the common people are kept ignorant and in the dark. The uneducated people are easier to control. Right? So maybe they go through a school system and the goal changes from academic achievement to behavior modification. Instead of saying, we want you to compete with, you know, the Asians and these other different, no, we just want you to learn how to surrender your values to whatever the state says. Right? We're going to make you surrender this, surrender that, and we're going to tell you there's no more even boy or girl. I mean, the kids are like, okay, what's next? Okay, I'll just throw away all my, whatever the state says. And so we had a little of that in America prior to the Civil War, where in some southern states, they made it a crime to teach slaves to read. So Frederick Douglass, the Republican advisor to Abraham Lincoln, writes in his autobiography of growing up on a plantation, and the slave master's sister-in-law was teaching him the alphabet. Her husband walks in, yells at her, says, don't you dare teach slaves to read. They'll grow discontent and run away. Frederick Douglass says, that was the first sermon that convinced me that I wanted to learn how to read. Another time he's a little bit older, he's in the house, they see him looking over someone's shoulder, sounding out words on a piece of paper, they snatch the paper away, they chase him out of the house. And then he notices when there's business transactions and they're writing stuff out, he'll learn how to read. And then he would teach the other little slave kids by writing in the dirt. And then he ended up going to a church, and he learned the Bible, and then he'd have a little Sunday school class, and then it got broken up by the plantation owners and so forth. Anthropologist Claude Levi Strauss said ancient writing's main function was to facilitate the enslavement of other human beings. So when Moses comes down the mountain, he does not just have the law, he has something else. He has the law in a 22-character alphabet. First letter's Aleph, second letter Beth. Sound familiar? It is so easy to learn, kids could learn it. No longer is reading and writing this secret knowledge of this elite ruling class everybody could read. And so Israel is the first instance of an entirely literate population. And so the priest taught the law, but they also taught the people how to read the law. Eusebius, a early church father, quotes from a Greek guy named Eupolemus, 158 BC. He says, Moses was the first wise man that he taught the alphabet to the Jews, who passed it on to the Phoenicians, who passed it on to the Greeks. And some of the, you know, archaeologists say, well, we don't have records of the Jews being able to write back then. Well, gee, God told them not to carve in stone when they were making altars and so forth. Where the pagans, they would have their temples and they'd carve in the stones. The Israelites had to pile up rocks, 12 rocks or whatever, that were not carved by hand. And so for that entire first, you know, period in them coming into the promised land, they could read the law. We know that because Joshua, covered one rock and wrote the Ten Commandments on there. But it was not carved, and they didn't carve in the stones. Anyway, Harry S. Truman said, the fundamental basis of this nation's laws was given to Moses on the Mount. So how am I doing? Are you still following me? Did I put anybody to sleep yet? Is this interesting? And all right. So, spectrum of power. One side's total government, the other side's no government. Remember we did that at the beginning, concentrated power, separated power? So, separated power would be anarchy unless each person was taught the law. It's like everybody downloads a behavioral app on their iPhone. Instead of a GPS app telling you where to turn, it tells you how to act in real time. Don't steal that. I see you. Don't be mean to that person, right? And the Levites are the computer geeks that help you to download the app. Right, go to Google's Play in the Apple Store and press this button here, press line upon line, precept upon precept, and everybody downloads the app and they memorize it in their heart. But wait a second, what would motivate you to follow an internal moral? Ancient Israel has the key ingredient. There's a God who is watching everyone. He wants you to be fair, and he's going to hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal, nobody's around, and then you say, wait a second, God is watching me. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable in the future. Maybe I should hesitate stealing. It creates something in your head called a conscience. If everybody in the country really believes this, you can maintain complete order with no police. Now, God knew that the Israelites were going to break the law, and rather than them walking around forever with this guilty conscience, once a year they had the Day of Atonement, and they brought the sacrifice's blood and sprinkled on the mercy seat, and everybody's sins were forgiven for the next year. And obviously, we understand that Jesus Christ is the sacrifice, and his blood was forever permanently put on the altar, so we have access and relationship with God through Christ. Ronald Reagan said, without God, there's no virtue because there's no prompting of the conscience. Democrat candidate for president, William Jennings Bryan, said, a religion which teaches personal responsibility to God gives strength to morality. There is a powerful restraining influence in the belief that an all-seeing eye scrutinizes every thought and word and act of the individual. So, we got this situation that take the power of the king, separate it into the hands of the people. It's chaos. Unless each person is taught the law, why do they follow the law? There's God. Well, what if you get rid of God? Then you just got a bunch of rules that somebody made up. Why follow them? Some will, some won't. And those that won't are going to yield to their selfish side. And they're going to start robbing, stealing, killing, smashing windows, setting buildings on fire, trashing cities. And everybody's going to say, we need somebody to come along and restore order. And the government comes in and takes away the freedoms and puts in martial law. And so what happened with ancient Israel? The system worked for 400 years, as long as the priests taught it. When the priest stopped teaching the law, here's Eli, the high priest, the main dude that's supposed to be teaching it. His own sons are sleeping with women in the very tent where the Ark of the Covenant is. And then you have a Levite with a silver graven image in the house of a guy named Micah. Tribe of Dan comes along, takes the graven image, takes the priest, and says, you can be a priest for our whole tribe. And you're scratching your head as you read the story saying, what is this Levite priest doing with a silver graven image? Isn't that like one of the commandments? You're not supposed to have them? Right, he wasn't following them. And then there's the story of a Levite with a concubine. The law says the Levite is to marry a virgin of his own tribe. Here he is with a woman he's not even married to. He's not following the law. And they're traveling in a house surrounded by sodomites that bang on the door. Something about people that do that behavior. They're not content with doing it in their bedroom. They want to force it on others. And so the poor girl is raped and dies. And by the time you're grossed out with the story, you read this line, every man did that which was right in their own eyes. Why? Because the priests had stopped teaching them what was right in the Lord's eyes. It turns into this chaos. Everybody goes to Samuel the prophet. They said the self-government system's not working anymore. We want to be like all the other countries. We want a top-down king. Samuel cries, and the Lord tells him, they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. And so they get King Saul. Now, an interesting story. Saul is pouting that his son Jonathan made a league with David. And he says, none of you soldiers care about me. Well, this guy Doeg, the Edomite, says, King, I care. I saw David go to this city of Nob. The priest gave him some bread, gave him the sword of Goliath. Saul says, bring those priests here. He turns to his men and says, kill them. The men hesitate. Doeg, the Edomite, says, I'll kill them, goes out and kills them all. What just happened? The soldiers had been operating under the old system where every person individually is accountable to God to follow the law. The law says you need two or more witnesses before you condemn somebody to death. There's only one witness, Doeg. So they're like saying, this does not compute. We're hesitating. We still have a conscience. We're accountable to God. You're telling us to do this, right? Doeg says, King, I'm going to surrender my conscience to you. You tell me to kill, I'll kill. Right? You blow the trumpets, I'll bow. So wherever you get a king, a dictator, he wants you to give up your deeply held religious convictions, throw them to the wind, and say, okay, there's no more male and female. Okay, there's no more this or that. No more whatever you say, king, whatever you say, government. Right? Now, I don't know how much more I'll get through, but when the founders came to America, there were two groups of pastors. The first group for 150 years had a Calvinist base, Puritans, and they believed God has a plan for your life, your marriage, your family, your church, and your government. Find out what the plan is, put it into place. Right? Every member is supposed to be involved in the ministry. The word polis means city, so politics is the business of the city. On all that, we're in Hartford, we're church members, so they all got involved. Well, in the early 1700s, a second group comes over, and these are Germans, and they're pietists. What's that? Remember Martin Luther? He had a very personal revelation, the just shall live by faith. It's so personal that he's willing to stand up to the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. But some German princes say, hey, this is my chance. I'm going to break from Rome. Kingdom of mine, you are all now Lutheran. And the people say, okay, King, we're Lutheran. What do we believe? So for the people in these kingdoms, it was not the same personal revelation that Martin Luther had. It was just agreeing with some new doctrine. And so a revival movement starts called Pietism. That says being a Christian is more than just agreeing with doctrine. You have to have a personal experience with Jesus. And when you do, your life will change. And you'll no longer do the worldly things you used to do. Right? Like go to bars and brothels and lewd theaters and everything and get involved in government. Wait, what was that last thing? Yeah, government's filled full of worldly people. If you're really a Christian, you won't hang around the worldly people. You won't get involved in government. That was the beginning of separation of church and state. Right? And so there's a ditch on either side of the road. One is, okay, I'm believing in doctrine, but it's not personal. And the other is, okay, it's personal, but it's so personal, I'm going to forget my responsibility that a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. It's just me. And so in the early church, and you know, the 4th century turned into a monastic movement where they would go off and live solitary in caves. But during this time, it was this idea that you pull yourself out from being involved in the government. There were even some German princes that donated money to the pietist churches so they would teach their people not to get involved in the prince's business. This caused the concept of the two kingdoms and they don't touch, and the German church stood back and allowed Hitler to take power. Right? And it took millions of people dying stopping Hitler because the church had said, oh, we're not going to be involved. We're so spiritual. We were just going to concentrate on a harder relationship with God. and we're going to neglect responsibility. Does that make sense? So we have to realize it is a personal relationship with God, but it's a cross. We have a vertical relationship and a horizontal relationship. We're responsible to show our love to God by showing our love. We got to have this responsibility for our community. You're responsible for your family, right, your neighborhood, and so forth, but ultimately your country. So, and I don't know if I'll get through this, but I'll just keep talking until the time goes. So these German pietists come to America, and the founders of the German pietists were Henry Muhlenberg. He has two sons, John Peter and Frederick. John Peter hears Patrick Henry's "Give Me Liberty, Give Me Death" speech, and then he goes to George Washington and says, "I want to help." Washington says, "I'm going to make you a colonel. Go get your men." Goes to a church, has a sermon. Ecclesiastes, time for all things, time to gather stones, scatter stones, time to preach, time to fight, takes off his uniform, right? You know the story. And his brother is John Peter, and he's writing letters saying, "You have gotten involved in matters which as a preacher you have nothing whatsoever to do." So he's sort of like this super spiritual, and John Peter writes back and says that he's a British sympathizer. Frederick writes back, says he can't serve two masters. And then the British bombard New York. Frederick's church is burned. His wife and kids flee. And he changes his mind. Maybe we need to get involved. He gets elected to Congress, and he's the first Speaker of the House. And that's where they pass the First Amendment. So does anybody honestly think that these two Lutheran pastors would vote to outlaw themselves? Would they vote to say, pastors shouldn't be involved in politics when we are pastors and we are involved? And both become congressmen and one the Speaker. And then last thought is, how did covenant turn into social contract, turn into socialism? So the pilgrims had a covenant form of government. What's that? It's people in agreement with each other, rights from God, accountable to God. In the next century, covenant turned into social contract. And it was people in agreement with each other, with or without God. If he's there, he's distant. Comes from the scientific revolution, Isaac Newton, this idea that there's laws of the universe, laws of planetary motion, laws of gravity, and maybe God made laws and sort of wound up a clock and set it on the table, and so everything's just following these laws. And so it's a distant God thought. Right, so Age of Enlightenment, social contract with a distant God. The next century, it turned into the French Revolution, which was a social contract intentionally without God. And that gave birth to socialism and Marxism, where the state is God. And so Hegel, who was one of the Germans, he says, the state is God walking on earth. We must worship the state. Napoleon conquers Prussia, and the king says we need to strengthen the state, and so Hegel comes along. Listen to this one quote. This is Rousseau, who wrote The Social Contract. When the state says to a citizen, it is expedient for the state that you should die, he ought to die, because his life is a gift made conditionally by the state. And here's Pol Pot in Cambodia. He says, to keep you is no benefit, to destroy you is no loss. So he kills millions of people, a third of his country. Why? Because your life is only of worth if the state says so. Once you get rid of God, rights come from the state, you're accountable to the state. And anyway, who was a member of the young Hegelians at the University of Berlin? Karl Marx. And so he starts all this Marxism. Once you get rid of God, the state becomes God. And so Hitler was the head of the National Socialist Workers Party, and Stalin was the head of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And even FDR says the Soviet Union is run by a dictatorship as absolute as any dictatorship in the world. Anyway. So socialism is a hierarchical system, like a pyramid. You got the dictators at the top, then the Communist Party members are the new royalty. They get the special treatment, and the people are the subjects. Eisenhower said, in many lands, the state claims to be the author of human rights. If the state gives rights, it can and inevitably will take away those rights. The founding fathers had to refer to the creator in order to make their revolutionary experiment make sense. It was because all men are created by all men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights that men could dare to be free. So in other words, it was this idea that we got rights from above the king's head. Amen. And the king, if he violates those rights, we can get rid of him. Anyway, so we go through these 6,000 years of history. We see these empires and kingdoms, they keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Clearly, there's a global goal in mind. The King of England was the biggest at the time of the founding. America's founders broke away, flipped it. So who's the king in America? Signer of the Constitution says the magistrate is not the king, the people are the king. Chief Justice John Jay said the people are the sovereign of this country. James Wilson signed the Constitution. Sovereignty resides in the people. They have not parted with it. Lincoln: the people of these United States are the rightful masters of both Congresses and courts. Here's Grover Cleveland: the sovereignty of 60 millions of free people is the working out of the divine right of man to govern himself, a manifestation of God's plan concerning the human race. So who's the king in America? We are. Word citizen is Greek for co-king. All right? James Wilson, every citizen forms a part of the sovereign power. He possesses a vote. People say, Romans 13, you got to submit to the governing authorities. Well, who's the ultimate governing authority in America? It's the people. Right? The politicians are our servants. It'd be sort of strange for a king to submit to a servant. Okay, butler, what am I supposed to do today? No, no, no. You tell them what to do, right? Now, imagine visiting a king, maybe in the Old Testament, going through the streets of Jerusalem, and you're witnessing murder, rape, and crime, and you finally get into the king's chamber, and he's all worried. He looks up at you, and he says, did you see all that crime coming in here? I wish somebody would fix it. You like reach your tap him on the shoulder and say, excuse me, you're the king. This is your kingdom. You're the one accountable to God to fix it. That's like somebody in America watching TV, seeing all the terrible stuff going on, saying, I wish somebody would fix it. Hello, have a finger reach through the TV tube and tap you on the shoulder. You're the king. You're the one accountable to God to fix this mess. Well, I need somebody to tell me what to do. Since when does the king sit on his throne and say, hey, you know, butler, tell me what to do? So Chief Justice John Jay says the Americans are the first people whom heaven has favored with an opportunity of choosing the forms of government under which they should live. All other constitutions have derived their existence from violence or accidental circumstances. And he ends with this, your lives, your liberty, your property will be at the disposal only of your creator and yourselves. If I were to sum up the greatness of America, it's this line right here. Your lives, your liberty, your property are at the disposal of you and God. There's no government in between telling you where to live, who to marry, what clothes to wear, what church to go to. You get to decide all that. You get to be the king of your life. And people say, well, Jesus is the king. Yeah, Jesus is the king over every person. But in America, every person has the voluntary opportunity to surrender yourself to the King of Kings. Right? You get to take off your crown and cast it at his feet. And so it says in Psalms, thy people shall be willing in the day of his power. So he's the king because we willingly submit our lives to him. We have that free opportunity to choose him, and we exalt him as the king. So and then I end by saying, who are the counselors to the king? It's actually the pastors, right? So you ever see the movie The Lord of the Rings? And there's a scene of a king, Theoden, and he has a spell cast on him, and he has two counselors. One tells the king to go to sleep, this greasy, ugly guy named Wormtongue. And then there's another counselor named Gandalf. And Gandalf casts the devil out of the king, and he starts to wake up. I love this scene because he sort of comes to. And he looks around the room, and he says, dark have been my dreams of late. It's like, yeah, you've been out of it with a spell cast on you by these counselors that tell you to sleep, sleep, sleep. Right? And you have other set of counselors, which is why I love your pastor so much, that throw ice water on their congregation. It says, wake up. You don't just have the right to vote in America. You're going to be held accountable to God for what happens, right? You're the king. And the most important thing is to bring people to Christ. Second most important thing is to preserve the freedom to do the most important thing, right? So the gospel is the most important thing. If you really believe that, you will be involved wanting to preserve the freedom to preach the gospel. Amen. Because if the other side has their way, in China, They're bulldozing down churches. They're taking away your freedom. In Islamic countries, it's the death penalty, right, if you preach the gospel. And if the LGBT agenda has their way, remember a couple years ago in Houston, there was the first lesbian mayor of Houston. She wanted to censor all the sermons of all the pastors. If the other side has their way, they will take away the freedom to preach the gospel. So if you really believe the gospel's the answer, you need to preach it, but also be involved in wanting to preserve the freedom to preach it. Anyway, I'll end with that.